Hey, and welcome back to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. I'm back from Qingdao, China, finally over my jet lag. I attended the CLIVAR Open Science Conference, which is only the second one. About 10 years ago, there was one in Baltimore, and this one was organized by the new Qingdao National Laboratory for Marine Science, which is an absolutely breathtaking facility of astonishing scope. They have 8 individual laboratories there and a massive new facility, and they're putting in unbelievable mooring arrays, for example, throughout the South China Sea, and launching new partnerships in Australia and at Woods Hole, for example. So seeing the scope of the work going on there was pretty inspirational, kind of amazing. Also did a 2-day masterclass with Bronwyn Wake from Nature Climate Change, kind of a writing workshop explanation of how high impact journals operate, what the editorial process is like. That was pretty fun. And then attended the first day of a Global Ocean Summit, which brought together some of the major players and oceanographic institutes from around the world to kind of give high-level discussions of what they're doing, where they're trying to go, and what the future of oceanography is going to look like. And it's actually looking pretty encouraging. Today's guest on the show is an oceanographer with an interest in the past. It's Amelia Chevenel from the University of South Florida, previously at UCL. I thought it'd be fun to talk to Amelia, well, partially because she has this interesting career trajectory going from UCL, where she was tenured, back to the U.S., and it turns out that, as is often the case, it was a combination of personal family reasons, but also financial reasons. Working in London is incredibly expensive, and the salaries typically for geoscientists are not really commensurate with what you might need to live there and support a family. She's also done a lot of work and is still doing quite a lot of work on trying to understand what the Antarctic ice sheet does. And what it's looking like is that it's far more dynamic at shorter timescales than we really thought was possible previously. Not from some kind of an intellectual block in the topic, but simply because the data weren't available. Amelia and her colleagues are now working to bridge the existing deep ocean records with new records from the continental Antarctic shelf and linking that to ice sheet processes, combining geochemistry and the new modeling that's coming online. So that's been an incredibly exciting and interesting development. In other news, as part of my midterm appraisal at Nature, I decided to try and build up my own knowledge and understanding of climate and economics and sustainability. And as part of that, I met with Solomon Tsang from UC Berkeley a little while ago to chat about climate economics. And I'll be going off to the major American economic meeting in Chicago. I think it's in January. So, gosh, I don't know. Chicago in January doesn't sound all that appealing, but I'm still going to go. If any of you out there know of any good workshops or meetings that are in this realm of climate, economy, and sustainability, I'd love to hear about it. With that, on with the show. Amelia Chevenel from the University of South Florida. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So we were having emails back and forth about scheduling, and you had mentioned that you were going to the International Congress on Paleoceanography, which just took place in Utrecht a couple of weeks ago. And when you came back from that meeting, I think you mentioned something to the effect that this ICP had been a bit of a placeholder. Can you talk about what you meant by that and what you were expecting going in and what you didn't see coming out of the meeting?
A little bit. I think, you know, these are only my opinions and probably don't represent the opinions of the field entirely, but I'm a big picture person. I like to think about big questions in the climate system and how we can solve those questions using paleoclimate evidence. And what I saw at ICP were a couple of talks that did that really well, and then a couple of talks that just got into the minutiae of the proxies that we're using. Yeah, just the details, and I wonder if we're going down the wrong track. I know that in the past, we've looked a lot at diagenesis in foraminifera, and we've made some really important discoveries. And at the end of the day, we kind of incorporate those discoveries into our new methodologies, but the details of how forams incorporate magnesium, for example, in individual chambers seems to be more of an academic exercise than a paleoceanographic exercise.
So you think that that kind of audience would be better served by going to or presenting at Goldschmidt, for example?
Yes. That's my own personal opinion. Maybe that's just because of who I am.
So let's take back to where you came from and where these ideas came from. You grew up in the Boston area and went to a private high school in the Boston area. Did you already have this kind of perspective on big picture thinking back then, or did it arise over time for you?
I think I've always been a big picture person. In high school, I was really interested in climate and I was really interested in science, but they didn't really have anything for me to do in the classroom. So I was always one of those kids that had done everything or had thought about everything and they needed to give me something more before I became destructive. So at that point, my uncle is a geologist and he was one of Bruce Hazen's students at Lamont when he died. And he went on to get his PhD, but it took a long time. And so he was always giving me projects to do and adventures to have. And in high school, for my final project, I did an independent study on tree rings. And looking at the climate of the Durham, New Hampshire area over the past, it was like 100 years. And that's what I did for my independent study.
You mean you were going out as a high school student and taking cores around the Durham area?
Yeah, so I went up to visit my uncle and took cores in his backyard, took cores in, you know, around campus, and then went to the dendrochronology lab at UNH and analyzed them.
That's quite a project for a high school student. Now, you mentioned that you were doing this so that you wouldn't get destructive, I think you said. What would you have done if you hadn't been doing this? Like, what would have been destructive at that point in your life?
I think I just get bored pretty easily, and I always want to figure something out, and I always want to learn more, and I always want to solve a puzzle. And if I feel like I've solved the puzzles that are thrown at me, then I need something else. And this was a puzzle I couldn't solve, and that was pretty exciting.
Did you find anything of great interest from this centennial analysis of tree rings?
Oh gosh, I can't even remember. Probably something horribly flawed.
I don't remember it being submitted to Nature.
It was not, no.
You then went on to a bachelor's at Hamilton College where it looks like you worked with Jean Domack. How did that arise?
I took geology and was a geology major. And really, I came into geology mostly because of my family history, both my uncle and also my great aunt was Mary Sears, who was one of the first female oceanographers at Woods Hole. And so she was always telling me about going and having big adventures and being able to solve problems and doing anything that I wanted to do. And I felt like geology, you know, those were the students who were outside, who were having fun, who were going on field trips, who were doing research, and that really appealed to me. And so that kind of combination of influences led me to the geology department at Hamilton.
When your great aunt talked about adventures, did she mean intellectual adventures or did she mean the act of going to sea, the seafaring, working in ships?
So I think a little bit of both. When I was a child, she used to give me children's books. And I have a whole series of children's books where she would write on the front cover, you can do anything you want to do. You can be anything you want to be. And these books included books like Swallows and Amazons and, you know, real sort of seafaring adventures. They were just pretty exciting.
I always have a difficult time with that specific kind of analysis because I feel at some level it's just not true. There are some fields that I could never do. I'm never going to be an NFL linebacker, for example. Just physically, I'm completely unsuited to a vast range of careers. But I guess the spirit is that, you know, within the constraints of who you are, your physical abilities and your, you know, your innate mental skills, you have this wide range of options. How did you interpret what she was saying? Did you take it literally, or did you take it like sort of within a range of contexts?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer your question other than to say I was both a geology major and a studio art major. So that might actually help you.
What did you do in studio art?
I did ceramics, not too far from geochemistry and sedimentology.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, I do pottery. I've put that on hold a little bit until after tenure, but it is one of my great loves.
You didn't stay with tree rings for the long term. How did you begin to ooze over into the paleoceanography realm?
I took Gene Domack's sedimentology class. And in that class, he gave us some readings from Jim Kennett's marine geology book. Mm-hmm. And I remember we didn't have to buy the book because it was so expensive, but we could go and read it in the library. And I would just sit there and I would read all of the stories about ice sheet development through time and, you know, his drawings of ice shelves and sedimentation. And I just thought, wow, this guy's interested in everything I'm interested in. At that time, Gene had an undergrad program where he was sending students to Antarctica. And it was always kind of mysterious how you got to go. But I actually was selected to go at that point. And I was really interested in trying to understand the climate of the past. And at that point, the last 10,000 years. Was something that I was really interested in.
Was this in the mid-90s when you were selected?
Yeah, so my first trip to the Antarctic was in 1995.
When I talked to Robin Bell about her early days going to Antarctica, she said that the climate for women scientists in Antarctica wasn't always great and that there were some difficulties about in being female in the early days of Antarctic science. When you went there for the first time, how did it seem to you?
For me, I was on a really great cruise. There were a lot of female graduate students. I was an undergraduate, so I really didn't know any better. I think, you know, people treated me with respect. They treated me as the only undergraduate on the ship. Yeah, I didn't notice. I was just excited to be there.
It sounds like it clicked immediately with you as something that was worth pursuing over the long term.
It did. Once you go down there, you can't ever forget it.
In 1996 to 98, you appear to have taken a detour to do some consulting for a water engineering firm. How did you get into that, and what led you to come back to work on your graduate degrees?
Those are the dark years, the mysterious years. So I moved to Alaska. After graduation, I needed a break. I needed to figure out what I really wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So when I ended up in Juneau, Alaska, I thought, well, I don't really have any skills, but I can do chemistry. So I applied for a job at a lab in Juneau, and the person who interviewed me had gone to UC Santa Barbara, and she had gone to Antarctica as an undergrad as well. So all of a sudden, in the middle of this interview, we discover this, and it was a great bonding moment. I got the job. I worked in the lab, and I also then worked out in the field as a consulting geologist and got to travel around Alaska. And I think what brought me back, so I got increasingly frustrated with just being told, well, here are the samples that you need to analyze for metals. Just give me the data. And I would say, well, why? What are we trying to figure out? What does it mean? And that was definitely not encouraged. At that time, Gene had a position on a cruise that was going down to the Gould, one of the U.S. Antarctic Program ships. It was the first cruise, marine geology cruise of the Gould in 1998. And it was going down as a support vessel for the Joides Resolution. And that was when they were drilling Site 1098, which I've worked a lot on, in the Palmer Deep. I was able to go and see the drill ship and experience being out at sea and in the Antarctic again. And that sort of combination of things, this sort of dissatisfaction with my job, just in terms of the depth of knowledge that I was getting, and this incredible experience going to Antarctica again, was what drew me back in. And I decided hey, this Kennett guy, I really liked his book. I'm pretty interested in him. And so I contacted him, and shockingly, he responded.
And you moved to UCSB to work with Jim Kennett in 1998 and stayed there until you finished your PhD in 2004. But I think you also worked with David Lee when you were down there. Did you work kind of with a range of faculty in the area?
I did. Jim was always my primary advisor. But what I was really interested in was Jim is an incredibly big picture guy. And I absolutely appreciate that because that's the way I think. And at some point, I thought, ooh, I need to be a little bit more involved in the details. Back to what we were originally talking about this ICP. I need to understand how the proxies really work and think about them more critically.
And David knows that kind of stuff.
Yes, he does. And so I added him to my committee. At that point, I sailed as a sedimentologist on Leg 189 to the South Tasman Rise and developed a project on the Middle Miocene and trying to understand how Antarctica's ice sheets evolved during that time. And it seemed to me that one of the questions that hadn't been answered was how much ice and what was the temperature. David was really involved in working on the magnesium-calcium proxy at that time, and I thought, I wonder if I could do something, which was really risky. I mean, nobody had, Carrie Lear had done the original benthic, Cenozoic work, but nobody had really taken a stab at working with the planktonics in the pre-quaternary. And we all know that there are many issues with magnesium calcium, but those were kind of the glory days, right? And so I thought, okay, I can do this.
When you're going into a PhD project and you're contemplating biting off a topic that large and that that high risk, you run the risk of doing all this work and then coming up a dead end, either methodologically or conceptually. What did your committee say when you brought this idea to them?
I have to be fair. So this was my second PhD idea. The first idea was that I was going to work on the Oligocene. And there was some idea that we were going to recover Oligocene sediments and possibly at high resolution based on the seismics at the South Tasman Rise sites. Well, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that we had no Oligocene. And so my sampling request on the ship and my entire project basically changed in 15 minutes before our initial sampling meeting, where Jim said, we have no Oligocene, what are you going to do?
How about the Miocene?
And I went, ugh. Well, he didn't even suggest that. I thought, oh no, oh no. And I said, well, we seem to have recovered a lot of Miocene. And he said, okay, that'll be a good place to start.
I mean, the Miocene was, and I think probably still is, comparatively understudied compared to things like the PETM or the Eocene, Oligocene transition, or the Pliocene warm period. At the time when you were looking at this Miocene stuff, did you think, okay. Or were you thinking, fantastic?
I think I was thinking more of how am I going to make this different than what had been done previously? I didn't want to just increase resolution of a stable isotope record or do it in a different place. I really wanted to do something different.
The magnesium calcium.
Yeah, and that's where I came up with the temperature idea.
Can you back up to, it must be almost 15 years ago now that you were beginning to work in this, the major issues with magnesium calcium and what you were concerned about applying it to this location, this time period?
We were really more concerned with dissolution and with proper cleaning techniques. And so we analyzed a suite of elements that we were able to determine if there were any sort of cleaning issues, egregious cleaning issues. Did I put the pipette down? You know, did I hit somebody in the face with it, leading to a high iron content? Did I not wash my vials, rinse my vials correctly, things like that. The samples appeared visually well preserved. Now, this is before the glassy foram evolution.
Paul Pearson's glassy foram revolution.
Yes. You could see ultrastructures. We had geboloides, so a surface dwelling or upper water column dwelling foraminifera that had a magnesium calcium temperature calibration from the Southern Ocean. And that species was present in my cores. And so I thought, well, we know a little bit about how magnesium is incorporated into and the relationship between magnesium, calcium, and temperature in the Southern Ocean for the present. Can I take the risk of applying this in the past? And at that point, most people would probably stop their research and say no.
That's always the assumption you have to make when you're going back from a core top calibration to any previous time, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I know that very oftentimes there is that period of doubt where you think, oh, I can't do this. This is breaking all the rules. And then it's just a matter of getting up the next morning and moving on. And so I did. And the first three racks that I cleaned and analyzed looked amazing. And so we decided to continue on.
That work then led to a not insignificant publication. I think this was your 2004 paper in Science when you actually did reach a conclusion about the Miocene evolution of the Antarctic ice sheet. What did you find? And can you talk about what the reception was to that 2004 publication?
We analyzed the geboloides, magnesium, calcium, and came up with a record of temperature across the Miocene climate transition, which is this period of time between 17 million years and about 13.8 million years. And so it incorporates a period of warmth called the Miocene climatic optimum. And then this period where we think the ice sheets expanded pretty significantly. And what my record showed was that we had, in fact, warm temperatures in the Southern Ocean during this Miocene climatic optimum, and that was encouraging. But we saw this stepwise transition that occurred in, so a cooling of about 7 degrees that happened before the oxygen isotopic shift at 13.8 that we see in all of the records and compilations of 018 records.
From the benthics.
Mm-hmm, yes. And so this planktonic record showed a series of steps that we believed at the time were orbitally paced. Our reviewers wanted us to be a little bit more forward about how we were interpreting that. And I felt as if the age model wasn't good enough at that point to be able to say anything.
What was the age model at the time?
It was based on biostratigraphic datums, and I had refined some of the 4M datums within this time interval, but also, you know, the shipboard stratigraphy. Since then, Ann Holborn has tuned the record and has improved our age model as well as the ones that she's worked on in the South China Sea.
So since 2004, what of those conclusions from that paper have stayed essentially the same? And in what other ways has the field either revised or added to those ideas you put forward?
I interpreted the magnesium calcium purely as temperature. And I think if push came to shove right now, I would still interpret it as mostly temperature. One of the things that has happened over this time period is that we have really begun to understand that the magnesium-calcium content of foraminifera is affected by salinity. And so if there were any changes in salinity at this time, and this is a really interesting area because what we said was that we interpret this as the polar front moving farther north and the subantarctic front moving farther north, which would cause both a cooling and a freshening of surface waters. That was how we interpreted it.
So there very likely would be some kind of convoluting effect of salinity.
There absolutely could be. And in her, I think it was her 2005 paper, Ann Holborn put that forward as an alternative hypothesis that maybe what we were seeing was just a change in salinity. And what she was saying was that maybe it was related to a change in the meltwater input into the Southern Ocean at that time.
From the East Antarctic Ice Sheet.
Possibly, yes. Maybe both. Some of the other things that have evolved are that, you know, in my paper, I really talk about the East Antarctic Ice Sheet and its evolution at this time. I think right now, I would be more comfortable with saying evolution of Antarctica's ice sheets.
Oh, not geographically split between east and west, for example.
Yeah, because I think, you know, at this time that we were writing this, there was this idea that the West Antarctic ice sheet formed later, you know, maybe in the late Miocene. And I think what we're discovering is that may not be entirely true. There was the idea that it was always grounded below sea level. I think Doug Wilson's sub-ice sheet topography and reconstruction suggested that it didn't have to be all submarine at that point. Hmm. And so you could actually grow ice in that area. Now, I don't know, but I think I would hedge my bets a little bit more now.
When I talked to Tina van de Vliert from Imperial, she was sort of saying that the lines of evidence are getting better for multiple areas. So you have things like the neodymium, magnesium, calcium, and the benthic data, but that there's emerging in the field this increased ability to link together the land-based evidence with the marine-based evidence and try to make these kinds of connections more clear. Do you see that happening specifically with the Miocene? And if so, what are you looking forward to in the next couple of years on that?
Tina is absolutely right. I think that there has been a real gap in what we understand from the deep sea records and what we understand from the Antarctic margin records, as well as from the terrestrial records. And there are a lot of us who are really thinking about how to bring those two communities together. And there's some personal politics in why they're so separate, as well as just some fundamental disagreements in how data is interpreted. And I think we're stronger together, to use a slogan. So I'm hoping that we are able to link the deep sea records and the margin records more in the future. What I'm seeing that's really exciting are some of the results that have just come out from Andrill in PNAS. And what they're showing are these very dynamic ice sheets in the Middle Miocene, perhaps even during the Miocene climatic optimum, where temperatures at the poles seem to be a lot warmer. This is what we saw on the South Tasman Rise. This is what people like Sophie Warney have seen in the pollen record from the Andrill sites, that the terrestrial record looked pretty warm. Yet what Richard Levy is seeing in this PNAS paper is that these ice sheets are very dynamic at this time. It's almost like we're having ice growth during a period of warming. And nobody's really said that out loud, except for Dietmar Schnicker in 1980. And I don't think he's in the field anymore.
Well, so that must be through just increased evaporation and precipitation.
One of the ideas we put forward in the science paper, and I still think it's worth sort of thinking about, is this idea that you change the transport of moisture to Antarctica sometime around the Miocene climatic optimum. To grow an ice sheet, you need moisture. You can't just be cold. And so we had to grow an ice sheet at that time. We had to change moisture. But what we also see is evidence from the dry valleys that suggests that the dry valleys became dry right at 13.8 million years ago, when we have this very large signal in the oxygen isotopic composition in the deep sea records, and where we see the cooling in both the surface and the deep waters on the South Tasman Rise. It suggests that we have this geomorphologic evidence for huge amounts of meltwater input, and then all of a sudden, nothing in the landscape has changed. So there has to be a change in moisture transport, at least to that area. And I think that Rich's PNAS paper suggests that there's this variability and a very dynamic ice sheet during that time that might be resulting from changes in moisture transport.
What specifically would be going on in terms of moisture transport to cause these changes?
So I have a couple of ideas. One is a longstanding idea that Jim Kennett actually made me take out of the science paper originally. And he'll probably get very angry when he hears this. So my idea kind of fits with what Ian Dial at UTIG has found, that I always thought maybe the circumpolar current wasn't particularly strong until the middle Miocene, and that increase in the strength of the current further isolated Antarctica from moisture, heat, etc.
Doesn't Howie Scherer's work with the fish teeth show that it took place well before that?
Yes, the idea has traditionally been from 1977 Kennett paper all the way to Howie's excellent work on the Eocene-Oligocene boundary is that you do end up getting development of the ACC at that time. So I'm suggesting it can be developed, but what if you have to reach a threshold of an increase in strength?
So I see, yeah.
That you more isolate. And so what Ian has found is that maybe the tectonic changes in and around the Drake Passage were such that you couldn't get very strong flow until this time. Now, that's sort of out there, but it's something I've been thinking about. I've also been thinking a lot about sea ice. And I think sea ice is something that we just don't understand.
Particularly for Antarctica.
Yes. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Like, we just don't understand it. Not in models, not in the paleo record. We have some indications from the diatom record, not great indications from this time period.
So how do you view the interaction with modelers? So you mentioned all these different ideas about the way that circulation could change. And this is traditionally a way for the modeling community to get involved to try and integrate the data from the geochemistry to constrain the model possibilities. But then if even in the modern day, the models have a hard time with, for example, Antarctic sea ice, and we still don't understand the modern day Antarctic topography beneath the ice sheet, much less in the past. Do you see that as a useful way to put these ideas about past circulation into an evaluating framework in models?
Absolutely. I think right now we're a little bit stuck in trying to understand how the ice sheet responds to CO2. One of the problems in the Miocene is that we don't actually get a very dramatic change in CO2 decrease that we would expect. We don't go from a high CO2 world during the Miocene climatic optimum to a low CO2 world. You know, it's pretty exciting to see some of the work that Ed Gathon and Rob DeCano are doing on this time period where they've actually been able to model these very dynamic ice sheets during a time period where CO2 doesn't change much. So they've sort of almost solved this hysteresis problem by working on adding this ice cliff feature that I think gives it the model some dynamic component. They also thought a lot about how the sub-ice topography may have changed through time. And I think those are two areas that we really need to think about. I don't know how we're ever going to solve the problems, but they're pretty interesting.
You've continued on with your interest in the Miocene since your graduate career. You did a postdoc in University of Washington and then moved on in 2007 to the UCL, University College of London, where you stayed until 2011. And during that process, got what sounds like the equivalent of tenure in the American university system, but then moved on in 2011 to Florida. Can you trace just briefly the career arc that took you to the UK and then back to the US?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. My dad lives in the UK. So applying for jobs after my postdoc at the University of Washington, working in the UK was not a stretch because I had family there. And my husband seemed willing to go.
You say seemed willing to go.
He was. It was great. And we had a wonderful time. And I met some amazing colleagues. And the interactions that I had there were absolutely incredible. The issue that we had was really a personal one. It's expensive to live in London, and it's really expensive if you have a kid.
Yeah.
And so we got to the point where she was going to start kindergarten or pre-K or whatever. I think it was pre-K. And we needed to make a decision. Do we come back or do we stay? My mom was here in the U.S. still, and she's lives alone. And so I was always worried because she couldn't move back to England. And so for personal reasons, we decided to come back to the U.S. I wouldn't change my time at UCL for anything. It was an incredible experience.
When I see job ads for geoscience positions in the UK, the salaries seem just appallingly low relative to the cost of living in London, for example. And I just couldn't imagine how academics, particularly with families, could really afford to live there. Do you find the same kind of salary disparity between the US and the UK, or does it seem more like just a cost of living difference?
The salaries were appallingly low. They give a London allowance, which is about £3,000, which in reality really only buys you the train ticket from where you can afford to live. I think they might need to, in the future, do some adjustments to the pay scale, because the pay scale is the same no matter where you are in the UK with the steps. And I think the London allowance was sufficient for our time, but I don't think it is now.
Yeah.
It's just really difficult. And so I could only afford to go into work 4 days a week. And I could only afford to send my daughter to nursery for 4 days a week.
And I imagine that both the salaries are better and the cost of living is vastly lower at the University of South Florida.
Yes, absolutely. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I think when you were in London, though, at UCL, you published a paper in Nature on contextualizing the Holocene climate variability on the Antarctic Peninsula, which is obviously a very different time period and a bit of a different location than your Miocene work. How did you get involved in the Antarctic Peninsula work initially?
It might seem kind of funny, but actually I did my master's on Site 1098, which is what I published the text record in Nature from. And so I had worked on that site and I had seen it drilled. That was what I was talking about in the beginning of this interview when they were drilling the site on Leg 178. For my master's project, I'd work on doing the stable isotope record from the benthic foraminifera at that site. And I had always been really interested in trying to understand how temperature influenced the ice sheets in the past and sea ice. And I had been thinking pretty early on in my master's paper about the role of circumpolar deep water and how circumpolar deep water had influenced ice retreat in that region over the last 10,000 years. And I found some interesting things that we published in paleoceanography in terms of bottom water temperature, but I was never really satisfied. I always wanted to try to understand how temperature changed at the margins. So a lot of what I'm interested in now is really understanding that contact between the ocean and the ice sheet and the response.
The idea here being that this is the area where you could have the upwelling of the circumpolar deep water interacting with ice shelves and potentially destabilizing the broader ice sheet. Is that about right?
Yeah, that is about right. And we see a very strong circumpolar deep water signal in this region right now. So it's one of the places on Earth that's warming most rapidly. And if you look at the long-term trend, and depending on which record you believe, as you well know, I think that was the motivation for trying to develop a record from this location. And really, I was incredibly interested in looking at the temperature, but I also needed to do it on a budget. So I was working with Anitra Ingalls at the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. We had a small amount of money from NSF, I think it was $26,000.
Wow.
To work on this record. I thought, well, we need a place where we have a great chronology. The Palmer Deep, Site 1098, had a fantastic radiocarbon chronology that we're actually continuing to improve to this day. But that enabled me to actually just focus on the proxy work rather than trying to develop the chronology and then the proxies. So there had been a substantial amount of work done at this site for many, many years, and we were just adding to it.
So you could come in with this, I think at the time, relatively new proxy, TEX 86, and apply it within the context of the existing age model.
Yes. We were going to just move forward and make that leap of faith that I was talking about earlier. Like, I don't know if we can do this. And Anitra and I decided, well, we could try. May not work.
What were you thinking about TEX86 at the time? I know there's been a lot of controversy about the, in particular, the absolute calibration and the application to time periods or temperatures that are outside of the calibration range. How did it seem to you at the time in terms of something that you can look at for absolute versus relative changes?
I think I'd like to start by saying that this record still, I think, needs to be interpreted in terms of relative changes over time, not absolute
not
changes.
Not absolute.
That the calibration is not good enough and that we don't really understand what the archaea are really responding to. Anitra was really aware of this and these issues with trying to understand whether ecology was in some way involved in the number of ring structures that these archaea were putting into their lipid membranes, whether nutrients played a role, whether it was only temperature. And so when we were thinking about our results that miraculously looked pretty interesting and a lot like other records from the Southwest Pacific region, we were thinking a lot about, like, well, if TEX actually is showing something like nutrients, then how would we explain it? And we went back and forth, and you probably remember some of this, but we decided if it was nutrients, that it would actually be the same forcing mechanisms because circumpolar deep water is very nutrient rich.
Right.
We developed this record. We also decided to do a regional calibration study where we looked at the core tops from pretty much every core that we had a reliable core top in the region to see if and how these core top TEX values plotted with the larger global data set at that time was the KIM 2010, I think we ended up using, data set. Palmer Deep is interesting in that we know how cold the temperature can get, and we also know sort of the average annual temperature from the LTER studies that have been done there over the past 25 years. So what we did was we looked at these core top values, which again, sort of miraculously fall somewhere near the calibration line, which has a huge spread in those lower temperatures. And work that Ann Pearson has done since then has shown that this spread may actually be related to differences in environment and location. So that spread actually is differences between the Arctic and the Antarctic. So maybe ecology is somehow involved in how these archaea are responding. There were lots of questions, but what we found was this long-term cooling through the Holocene that we interpreted as a local orbitally forced signal. And we will say that the error is large on the calibration, and that's fine for now. We're working on improving it. But we also saw millennial scale variability, in particular this very warm period that started about 1,500 years ago that the reviewers really wanted me to say more about and perhaps name. And I really resisted. The only other sort of missing part of this record was that we didn't have the last 200 years, I think, to be fair.
Just from the core top wasn't available?
Yeah, just from the core top. And actually, my student just generated that data.
Oh, really?
And presented it at ICP. And it looks a lot like what we're seeing in not only the ice core records, but also in the measured temperature observations mm-hmm. from the peninsula.
Interesting.
And that's dated with lead 210. We put this record of temperature over the last 10,000 years out there using this pretty controversial, and even more so since then, proxy. And we were the first people to do it. We took that leap of faith. And what was really fascinating to me was that in 2012, Mulvaney and others published in Nature as well the James Ross Ice Core record of temperature. And what we had proposed was that perhaps there was a teleconnection driven by maybe the tropical Pacific, maybe the Antarctic, I don't know, but changes in the position of the westerly wind field through time that helped set up this dipole between the western Antarctic Peninsula and the eastern Antarctic Peninsula. What we proposed was if the westerly winds were driving things, that what we should see is millennial scale warming that we do see, and it should be cooling on the eastern side of the peninsula. And I don't know how they did it, and I'm very, very grateful to them, but the ice core record actually shows just this. It shows a long-term cooling through the Holocene that we see, although there's this, you know, we see, I think, 2 degrees, and they see about 1 degree, but that's within error, I would say, of both of our proxies. And then when we see this really rapid warming and warm interval, they see a cooling. And that's exactly what we would predict and what we did predict.
It was this amazingly serendipitous series of submissions.
It really was. I was like, I couldn't be more happy about it.
But I think, you know, overall, it just makes the really interesting point that even through the Holocene, we can still pick up the importance of changes in circulation, atmospheric circulation, as they manifest in both the ice cores and in the marine record.
Yeah. You know, I think in this particular location, it definitely is, and this is what I've always argued, it is atmospheric changes in circulation that are driving changes in circumpolar deep water onto the shelf. When we published the record in Paleoceanography in 2000, people asked us if maybe it was changes in thermohaline circulation and the amount of circumpolar deep water. We argued no at that point, and I would still argue that based on the ice core data.
The same year that you published the paper Nature on the Antarctic Peninsula, you also published in Nature Geoscience a commentary entitled Closed Ranks in Oceanography, in which you and two colleagues documented the way that the hiring practices, or at least the representation of women in paleoceanography, had changed, it seemed to be, for the worse, with a smaller percentage of women getting PhDs from several of the major oceanographic schools and going on into faculty positions, decreasing over time. And you discussed how this could be due to changes in women's preferences for family priorities, but also the possible changing practices of hiring in these sorts of departments. And this generated a bit of discussion in Nature Geoscience, but if you think about what you were thinking then in 2011 versus now, has the field changed? Has your own thinking about that topic changed over time?
Let me just clarify, that was actually physical oceanography. So I was brought in on a project looking at only at physical oceanographers.
Right.
But I think probably we could expand this discussion to oceanography in general. And what we found was that women weren't making it to the faculty ranks in the sort of percentage that we thought that they should. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that's probably true today. There are a lot of women who move on into soft money positions, and sometimes that's a two-body problem. Yeah, I wish we'd made more progress than we have.
What has your own experience been at Florida? You mentioned that you had a young child when you were in London. That was one reason you chose to move back to the U.S. You're now going through the tenure application process. How has it been managing your young family and writing grants in the tenure process at Florida?
Well, I can give you one answer, and I'm sure my husband could give you another answer. It is obviously incredibly difficult to juggle work, life. There is no balance. Everybody who says there's balance is lying. At least I haven't found any balance. I can say that I'm incredibly lucky because I have an incredibly supportive spouse who does all the dirty work, and he doesn't get enough credit. There are often times when he is just picking up the pieces while I'm getting a grant ready, while I'm, you know, trying to submit a paper. I think that in reality, I just have fewer hours in the day to work. You know, she needs things from me. I need to fulfill my obligations to her as her parent. And I just can't spend my entire life working. And in some ways, that's really great, right? To have that sort of revelation. And in other ways, like when you're coming up for tenure, it's incredibly stressful. My sort of feeling is, and I hate this term, but I'm going to say it, it is what it is. I really couldn't do what I do without the support of my husband. And a little shout out. So when we moved back here, my mother moved down and she moved a block away, and she has saved us more times than I can even tell you.
That could be great, or that could be absolutely Just gut-wrenching.
It's absolutely phenomenal with her. She is very respective of privacy, of, you know, almost to a fault. But it's wonderful. My daughter spends Mondays with her after school. They have a wonderful relationship. It's been fantastic. And I think my husband would say the same thing.
Wonderful.
So we're incredibly lucky.
I know that during your time at UCL, you had a huge investment of ship time and were involved in a lot of proposals that now through work with your students seems to be leading to some interesting and exciting work coming out soon. Can you talk about what that process has been up until now and what you see coming out over the next couple of years?
I was involved with two proposals to NSF when I was still actually employed in the UK. These proposals, my collaborators reached out to me knowing that I was in the UK, and they were incredibly generous. And we put in two ship proposals to do work in Alaska and also in East Antarctica, the Totten Glacier region. The Totten is sort of the entrance to the Aurora subglacial basin. It's incredibly exciting. We got ship time to go both to the peninsula and to East Antarctica. That ship time happened in 2012, 2013, and 2014. I've spent about 150 days at sea during that time, as have some of my students. And so that's pretty interesting, kind of pre-tenure, spending that much time at sea.
You're not writing papers during that time.
Exactly. And I'm not writing proposals, but I'm acquiring incredibly exciting new data. And so I just decided, you know what? I'm going to go for it. What we're going to learn in these two places is going to be my research program for the next however many years. You know, that's another gamble I'm really glad that I took, because we have an absolutely incredible record from Totten, both of the long-term history of the Aurora subglacial basin and its erosional processes and the expansion of ice out onto the shelf over the Cenozoic. But we also have a really incredible record through the Holocene that may be comparable to some of what we've seen at Palmer Deep that I was talking about earlier. Although this time we did it the right way, and that we took samples from the water column and surface samples as well as core samples to try to understand and develop both the TEX-86 proxy as well as there's incredibly well-preserved carbonate.
Huh.
So the magnesium-calcium records. We have a mooring at that site that we left in for a year that's been recovered.
And it lasted for the whole year?
Yeah, it did. It survived. It was incredible. We see evidence for some sort of warmer water on the shelf right now. Totten is a glacial system that is thinning pretty dramatically right now in terms of East Antarctica, and that's unusual. And that was why we went to try to study it. The records that we're developing from there, we have one long-term record that is in preparation right now. We're ironing out some of the last sort of biostratigraphy issues. It's also going to be submitted as a drilling proposal to IODP, probably by October 1st. The peninsula work is also incredibly exciting. We're looking at, again, how circumpolar deep water may have changed retreat rates, but more from the outer shelf towards the inner shelf through the Holocene.
You mean you have a gradient of sites along
the
peninsula?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, through one of these outlet glacier troughs. I also have some stuff that one of my students is working on that's really mature that came from an NSF grant that I got in 2013, I believe, 12 or 13, that's studying the past history of the Lambert-Amory ice shelf system. So it's the largest outlet glacier in East Antarctica. What we found is that this system is variable on millennial timescales through the last glacial maximum, well, sort of into stage three, so the last 40,000 years. We've been able to date it using a new radiocarbon preparation technique, which is really exciting, that we're using here at USF. And what we've shown is that the system retreats when we see these warm periods these AIM events in the Antarctic ice core records within our ability to date. And so we actually see millennial scale variability of these large outlet glacier systems, which has huge implications for sea level on millennial timescales. We see this variability in sea level that we can't account for just by variability in the West Antarctic. There has to be some involvement in the East Antarctic. These records fit with more distal records from the Southern Ocean of Mike Weber and an early record of Sharon Canfush and Dave Hodel that show millennial scale records of ice rafted debris.
It seems like people are finding more and more that the Antarctic ice sheet is, I guess you would say, just vastly more dynamic in response to relatively small changes in forcing than we thought previously, and that events like Meltwater Pulse 1A, which were always so enigmatic about having a lack of geological evidence from Antarctica to support the idea that it must have contributed, you now really are getting multiple lines of information from the modeling, from the geochemistry, showing that yes, it actually probably was startlingly dynamic.
Yeah, and I think this is something that we definitely have ignored, and not really because we are intentionally ignoring it, but because we just didn't have the sampling array that we needed. Coming back to what we were talking about earlier, this linkage between the shelf records and the terrestrial records and the deep sea records is really going to be extremely important. We can make all these inferences about what's happening from the deep sea record, but it's really the record from the shelf when it's preserved. And that's one of the really unique things about the Lambert system, is that we have a record that's preserved because ice had retreated landward of the margin by the last glacial maximum. We don't know why, going back to what I was thinking about earlier. I think it's moisture. That would be my guess, is it's moisture transport. Yes, we absolutely need to continue to develop records on the shelf and try to understand the variability that we see in these more complete deep sea records. And we're actually going to be doing that. So one of the other things that I've been doing since I got to USF is I've been getting back into the ocean drilling program from the US side. So I'm very involved both in the science advisory support sort of angle as well as the science angle, and have been involved in writing a proposal for the Ross Sea that is scheduled to be drilled in 2018 on the Joides Resolution. And that'll be the first time the resolution has been in the Ross Sea since 1973,
wow.
I think,
wow.
72. Fantastic. Yeah, that's really exciting. And we're going to be thinking a lot about this idea of a dynamic ice sheet through the neogene. And also have been involved with some work on the East Antarctic margin that Trevor Williams is headed, and looking at this greenhouse world at near Wilkes Land. So some of the earlier records of Eocene pre-glaciations and even Cretaceous warmth that they did not recover during Wilkes Land. And that will be drilled in 2018 as well, actually at the same time, using the seafloor drilling system that the BGS has. So I've spent a lot of time really trying to develop these drilling campaigns and working with large international groups to get the science ready so that we can drill and we can learn a lot more about how dynamic the ice sheet really is, where our assumptions are correct and where we've made possibly huge errors in what we've assumed.
Amelia Chavanel is working on a huge pipeline of data, it sounds like, to understand what makes the Antarctic ice sheet come and go and where and when. Amelia, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been really great to talk to you. I enjoyed it.
That was my interview with paleoceanographer Amelia Chavanel from the University of South Florida. Amelia, thanks again. That was fantastic. Should mention again that the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guests, not necessarily Nature or Nature's publisher. If you'd like the show, it's available for subscription through iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. If you're up for writing a comment or leaving a rating that's super helpful, it'll help make the show more visible to other people who might be searching for things like climate podcasts. Show notes are available at forecastpod.org, and you can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com. And one last thing. So before I sign off, Amelia and I were having some follow-up emails after the interview, and she told me this hysterical story about her pottery activities. And this is her email to me verbatim. "I did pottery at UCSB for years. My husband came in one day to take photos and noticed a guy with cool shoes that he liked on the other side of the ramshackle studio. He was just about to go up and talk to the guy and ask where he got his shoes when he heard his voice. My husband thought, I know that voice, and walked over. Well, it turns out that it was Jeff Bridges, who really does look like the dude. I had been doing pottery with him every Saturday morning for years at that point and had never noticed or recognized him. I just called him Jeff. Anyway, I then asked my teacher if that was Jeff Bridges, and he just laughed at me and couldn't believe I hadn't ever noticed, which is kind of funny because I notice everything and am usually not face blind. Anyway, Jeff used to make tiny masks of himself out of clay that he would leave as calling cards when he went to people's houses for dinner. There are a million of them floating around out there. I could have taken one, but I never did." So there it is, a great conclusion to the story of Amelia's alternate life as a potter.